danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 203 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Bullhead City, Arizona. This is Carlos Welch with Andrew Brogus. And in Melrose, Massachusetts, is Nate Mavis. How you doing, Nate?
Fantastic. How are you, Carlos?
I'm great, man. I'm great. Loving life.
I would be, too, if I were hanging out in Bullhead City, Arizona.
Yeah, it's probably sitting at about 60, 65 degrees right now.
Yeah, that's a lot more degrees than I got here. How far away is Bullhead City from either Talking Stick or Las Vegas?
2 hours from Las Vegas, and Talking Stick, I'm not sure, but probably, like, if I had to guess, I would say, like, 6 hours.
Yeah, that sounds right. That sounds right. Good. And what brings you there?
I am on location in my new house, man.
Nice. Nice.
I have a house now. good friend of the show, Alexander, the assassin of Fitzgerald, invited me to room with him at his uncle's house in Bullhead City, which is, for the listeners that remember the time I was on and talked about moving to Laughlin, Nevada. Bullhead City is just across the river from Laughlin. So I was already in the area, and just so happened that his uncle had a house in the area and he was coming back to the U.S. So we decided to just room together. And so far I've been here a week and I'm loving it.
Very nice. Very nice. I imagine Alexander is a good roommate.
Yeah, he is. So far, we've roomed together for one day because he came from Costa Rica, dropped off his dogs, and then he headed to Montreal for the WPT. But when he gets back, I'm sure he will be a good roommate. But for now, I got Andrew Brokers here instead, so that's just as good.
Fantastic. There was a joke that my friend Jason liked to make when I used to live out in Las Vegas for the summers that we should rent out every room in those poker houses twice, once to a tournament player who would sleep at night in the room, but then once to a cash game player who would sleep in the bed during the game, you know, when the tournaments were on, because there were non-overlapping sets of time when each of those kinds of player would be in the house.
That's actually a brilliant idea.
it's Nick Cast approved, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I am here also with Carlos in Bullhead City, and it's not maybe entirely, or I guess Carlos didn't describe these dogs that are here, but I think, like, dog sitting is kind of Carlos's chief responsibility while Alex is gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, those of you, maybe you can even just tell from his voice, like, Carlos is a large man, and these are two of the, like, tiniest, prettiest little, like, well, one's a Maltese and one's, like, half Maltese, is that?
Half Maltese, half poodle.
Yeah. So these are just, like, the sissiest dogs.
And if any of you guys ever watched Assassinato's Twitch channel, you may have seen a cameo by the puppies, so, yeah, I would definitely get a lot of double takes if I was out in public with these dogs, for sure.
And they have, like, pink collars, and I mean, they're just they're froofy dogs.
Right.
It's quite enjoyable and humorous watching Carlos interact with them, but they're very charming. I'm not usually a fan of this kind of dog, but they won me over very quickly.
I was going to say, are they crazy? A lot of times the little dogs are the craziest.
One of them's crazy, and the other one's more laid back. But even the crazy one is not as crazy as the stereotypical crazy dog. Nice. And I don't like the crazy little dog. And I generally don't like little dogs for that same reason. And, like, particularly, like, Chihuahuas are, like, really, I guess, attention seeking.
Yeah.
And these dogs, they have their moments of that, but they're not you know, as hyper as a chihuahua.
Very good. Very good.
And I was a little surprised because I don't really think of Carlos as like a dog person. I was kind of like, does Carlos like know how to handle dogs? But it turns out you didn't actually grow up with dogs.
No, I did. But the dogs that I grew up with were not like these dogs. And I'm not a dog person. And when you say grew up, that was like 15 age. So I haven't had a dog since I was like 14 or 15. And the way I described it to Andrew is that when I had dogs, I had hood dogs, which means these are like big dogs that like stayed on a chain in the backyard the entire time versus these little Paris Hilton dogs that you have to like, you know, carry around and like, you know, like they need way more attention than the dogs I grew up with. So yeah. 35-year-old Carlos is definitely not a dog person.
All the Maltese with a wet napkin. it's a sight to see.
Yeah, it's even the thing is, it was a doggy wipe, so it wasn't even a wet napkin. It was like a baby wipe that's specifically designed for dogs that I spend my own money on. So like, yeah. Only Assassinato could get me to buy like doggy treats and doggy wipes for some prissy Maltese.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm curled up here on the couch next to my awesome dog, Raylan, who's hanging out. So he's really my podcasting partner today. He's asleep, though.
He's a bigger dog, so is he like really laid back or is he hyper?
He is very, very laid back. He is a hound mix, and he values calmness above almost anything else in life, except like food and like snuggling up with his humans. So yeah, he's very, very calm. He's like 45 pounds, so there's probably a bit of quote unquote lab mix, which is usually a euphemism for pit bull. And I love pit bulls, but some people don't. Right. And yeah, but you know, mostly hound. We actually did one of those dog DNA, like you like swab your dog's mouth and you send it off to a lab and figure out, and they guess like what kind of dog you have. And yeah, so probably some beagle, shout out to Killing Bird, and probably some other kinds of hound too.
Cool.
Yeah. But he is asleep, as he usually is for most of the afternoon. Our midday walk was more grueling today than usual because it's so flipping cold here and there's all this snow, and it was a real hike, but it was nice. It was pretty.
So speaking of pit bulls, I didn't actually get to meet them, but you know, our other frequent guest Leo Wolpert has pit bulls, I believe, and I did get to see Leo over the weekend, so I'm just down. I got into Bullhead City last night.
But yeah. I'm sorry. Andrew, how are you? What are you up to? I've been completely ignoring you.
Yeah, we've covered Nate. We've covered Carlos. We've covered the dogs. We've been around to Andrew. I've been in Las Vegas the last couple of days, which I actually didn't even plan it this way. Turned out to be Super Bowl weekend, which is, of course, a good time to be in Las Vegas. And I think the games were of above average frequency and quality that weekend. But I that wasn't even intentional. But I got to... Yeah, actually, I saw quite a few podcast-affiliated people. I did 2 hours of recording with Matt Berkey for if people have been wondering. Actually, I guess by the time this is out, these probably will be released. But you know, I still owe a few videos for the Bay Area Urban Debate League fundraising campaign that I did at the end of the year. You know, the deal was I was going to be doing half an hour for every $500 that we raised, and I've only released 3 hours so far, so I've still got some to go. And Matt was kind enough to do 2 hours with me, so I got to see a good deal of Matt Berkey, and we've got some real nice strategy stuff from him that I guess probably will be live by the time people are listening to this. So I'll try to get a link to that in the show notes. But I got to see him. I ran into Tony Dunst just like at the Bellagio. We ended up playing a 10-20 game together, but that was just coincidence. You know, I just saw him getting on a list, and also ran into Jimmy Fricke while I was there, which I also owe Jimmy a thanks for some restaurant recommendations he gave me for Las Vegas. He definitely knows how to eat his way around that town.
Trust the other fat man.
Is he still doing that blog?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It is called Trust the Fat Guy, right?
Trust the Fat Man.
Trust the Fat Man.
But Jimmy Eats Vegas is the name of the blog.
I see. Right. I guess Andrew gave me this.
The business card.
Yeah, so yeah. His business card. So his blog is Jimmy Eats Vegas, but on the back of his business card, he has slogan, Trust the Fat Man. And I got the business card from Andrew, I guess, last summer. And on the way, no, it must have been a while back because I was on the airplane. I was in the airport with that card. And some random guy came up to me and says, "Why should I trust you?" I was like, "I'm not the fat man here, buddy. This is somebody else's card." But yeah, I too am fat, so trust the other fat man. I can't give you good restaurant recommendations unless you want to know about drive-through fast food stuff.
And then I got to see Leo Wolpert also.
Nice.
So I had breakfast with Leo one day, and the dogs came up, although I did not meet the dogs, which is what reminded me of that. But yeah, I got to, in addition to putting in a fair number of hours at the tables, I got to touch base with a bunch of podcast affiliated people, and now I'm hanging out with my favorite one of all.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And you guys just came back from Joshua Tree?
Yes, we were there. I guess I've mentioned this maybe on the show a little bit, but yeah, we spent a fair bit of time in Joshua Tree, and we'll be leaving town pretty soon. Actually, our original plan was to leave today, Tuesday. Is today Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday.
Today's Tuesday. Yeah, so our original plan was to leave today, and we were hoping we'd get to see you in Las Vegas, and then it turned out you weren't going to be in Las Vegas because you had to be here in Bullhead City to watch the dogs.
Right.
So then we changed our flight to Thursday so we could come down here and see Carlos and the dogs.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to be going Michelle Obama on Carlos. We're gonna get him hiking. We brought him a salad yesterday. We got
yeah. They did bring a salad, and also Andrew made stir fry and what was that, salmon?
Yeah, I made salmon last night. Stir fries tonight.
What was the stuff with the stuff? Just broccoli? What was that, cauliflower?
Yeah, that was just from Whole Foods, so that wasn't really.
Okay, yeah. I remember you told me you were going to make stir fry, and then yesterday when I had, I was like, I've never had stir fry with cauliflower in it.
Oh,
like,
there will be cauliflower in the stir fry, but.
Okay, yeah. I know what I ate last night was not what I pictured as stir fry in my mind, but I remember you said you were making stir fry. So I get, okay, so I was confused on that.
You still got that coming to you.
That, yes. That'll be here later, and then we'll. Like you said, we'll do some hiking, which I'm looking forward to. There's a lot of mountains around here, and I'm not exactly – I haven't ventured out to see what type of hiking opportunities there are. So I'm looking forward to doing that today.
Get up and get moving.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, other than that, you know, just being here, I'll say like the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've just been running insane online. Like I feel like I've made a – online final table every day for like the past 6 days of that I've played or whatever. So I don't know, this whole new life, new house dweller life is getting off to a pretty good start. So yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Well, and you're coaching now.
Yeah, I had a coaching client. So a guy reached out to me like December, I think, and asked me if I'd ever if I would be interested in coaching him. And I said I'd done a few hand history reviews for friends and that I hadn't like officially started coaching like strangers yet. But I told him I would get back to him after the holidays. And so once I got back out west, I did contact him and we had our first session yesterday. And it was more fun than I expected. Like I basically took his hand history and reviewed it before we got together to discuss. And I took notes on the hand history. Total, I probably spent about 7 hours working on helping this guy get better for the 1 hour that he paid. And also yesterday we did our first session. We did 1 hour. and it wasn't enough time to get through the notes. And so as we were wrapping up, I told him, like, you know, we'll just keep going so we can get through all these notes that I prepared the night before. And I was hoping he wasn't going to say no, because I was like, I did all this damn work. We're going to get through these notes. So I forced a free hour on the guy just so I, you know, my time, my effort of putting the prep together wouldn't be wasted. And I think that's just a function of me being a teacher. Like, you do all these lesson plans in your head, and you have you visualize how you expect it to go, and you know it went well, I think, but it wouldn't have gone well had I stopped at the amount of time he paid for. So yeah, this is probably going to be a problem for me going forward, because everybody's going to expect to like pay $50 for 7 hours of work out of me.
I doubt that. I mean, I hope not, at least. But you're saving all those notes, right? This is just screaming to be monetized down the road.
Yeah, everything is in a Google Docs file, so I'm definitely saving it. But the thing that's most fun to me about it is like seeing in these guys the same like reluctancy that I had when I was at their level, and just knowing where they will eventually be is like, I don't know, it's just super exciting to me. Like, I feel like I'm kind of in a time machine going back talking to Carlos from 3 years ago. So it's super fun, man. I almost enjoy it more than playing.
Nice. Very nice. Are you looking for more students?
I am.
All right. Well, can I be your hype man here for a second then?
Yes.
All right. Please. So, Carlos, if you listen to the show, you know he's an A+ guy, just sort of all around great. But I watch his Twitch stream not every time he goes online, but every time he goes online, and I have a spare minute, certainly. And I always learn something, usually many things. And you know, I think I know some things about tournament poker, but yeah, definitely he's a very clear thinker. He's even when he's not trying to coach me, I learn things. I imagine if he was trying to teach me things, I would learn even more. I think he's a good coach. I think if you want to be coached at rates that are lower than what some other coaches charge, you should get in touch with Carlos. And how do they do that?
They can contact me on Twitter at @hiphop101trivia. You can't contact me through Twitch. Twitter is the best way. And at this point, like I said, if you can catch me when I'm inefficient, like this first guy did, then you can get it for about $7 an hour. Because that's about how much I've made so far on this one. $50 an hour is the rate that I'm going to start at initially. And that could obviously change in the future, but that's what the going rate is right now. And I will say that you heard the glowing recommendation from Nate, and also Danny N13, Danny Noseworthy, who's a Tournament Poker Edge pro, retweeted my tweet about the coaching and said it was a good deal. And, you know, a great bit of what I've learned about poker, I've learned from TournamentPokerEdge.com. And so I will recommend, if you enjoy any type of poker content that I put out through Twitch or what you hear me talking about on podcasts, you should check out TournamentPokerEdge.com, because that's where I got the majority of my poker knowledge. Try to squeeze in an ad there somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's great. You saved us some work down the road. Yeah. Nice.
And this time it wasn't one of those long, heartfelt ads that had nothing to do about poker. Yeah.
Well, and I think you can also clearly see that Carlos is dedicated to wanting to see his students do better. So this is definitely not a just like a get rich quick scheme for Carlos. He's right. He's clearly very concerned about making sure that you as a student are going to get your money's worth.
It's funny. I woke up this morning like 7 a.m. and I sent some links to articles to reinforce what we went over last night with the guy. So I gave him like some extra reading after. So yeah, I think I'm more invested in him getting better than he is. It's like, I don't know, man. This is so fun. Yeah.
And speaking of getting better, I imagine like living with Alex Fitzgerald. I mean, that guy, from what I can tell from his, you know, blog and Twitch presence or Twitter presence and whatnot, has an insane work ethic. I have to imagine living with him is going to be good for your game.
Yeah, I'm a little bit scared because he is an absolute machine. Like, I don't know how he does it, and he just loves working on his poker business. He has. He runs Assassinato Coaching, and basically, I don't know, man. Sometimes it feels like 14 hours a day he's either coaching, producing video content for his YouTube channel, or working on webinars. And I think he is going to push me to work harder than I want to work. But if I can keep up with him, yeah, I'm going to, you know, my poker game will definitely grow by leaps and bounds, just, you know, being, you know, in his presence for sure.
It's funny because the fear you describe, like feeling inadequate around, you know, by with respect to work ethic in comparison to Assassinato, is not unlike the fear that other people fear being around you with respect to frugality. It's like you're probably thinking like, oh, man, he probably thinks I'm so lazy. And he's probably thinking like, man, I really want the guac on the burrito, but how will Carlos look at me if I get it?
Yeah. Emily, when Andrew and Emily showed up, she kind of slipped and let the cat out of the bag how much Andrew just paid for a hotel night in Vegas over the weekend. And, you know, I had a little skin crawl moment there, for sure.
And this was not a lot for a Vegas hotel room on a weekend. Like,
it was three figures.
That's what, when you said three, I thought you were gonna say like
hotel room.
Yeah, when you said three, I thought you were gonna say like 300 something, and I was like, nah, you can get that for like 129. That's fine, you know.
That is almost exactly on the nose, Nick.
Yeah.
I've been grinding Priceline pretty hard lately, so if there were some casino specific like supermarket sweep or Price is Right kind of game show, I think I would do really well.
This is also funny to me because Carlos has had the Game Show Network on all morning, so I've seen a lot more game shows in the last 2 hours than I have in the last year.
Yeah, a lot of 70s hairdos on these shows for sure.
Nice.
This hand is coming to us from Justin. Justin is playing a $2, $5, eight-handed game at the Hard Rock Casino. Justin describes himself, "I'm a skilled recreational player with a strong online poker background pre-Black Friday. I was in Tampa, Florida for business and had between 7 to 11 p.m. to play at the casino before my flight out. Villain is a 40-year-old regular who bought in for $1,000. I had no history with him in the 20 minutes he was at the table. I had never seen him re-raise anyone. He would only call or fold when facing a bet post-flop. Although, if he's only been at the table 20 minutes, yeah, that's not too strong of a read.
Oh, it's nothing. It's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, how many opportunities did he have to re-raise anyone? Like, okay. Three, maybe?
Yeah.
Justin says, I had raised four out of the previous five hands pre-flop, never went to showdown, and I had bet folded once. So Villain might perceive me as having a wide range and being too aggressive. I think I had a winning slash competent image. Hand in question. Hero has a $700 stack. He says, I was under the gun with Ace King and raised to $20, which was standard in this game. Suits don't end up mattering, so we'll ignore those. There are four callers behind, and the two blinds fold. So the flop, I think nothing too controversial so far. The flop is Ace Queen Nine Rainbow, $105 to the pot, $105 in the pot. Five players seeing the flop, our hero holding Ace King. What do we want to do here? Effective stack $700 at least between hero and one other players at the table. He doesn't mention the others.
So, man. So the stack to pot ratio is like eight, something like that?
Seven.
Seven, yeah. So part of me wants to check for the following reason. I'm going to have eight aces, queens, nines, and ace queen in my preflop ranging range. I might not bet all those on the flop, but ace king is not as near the top of my range as it usually would be. And for betting into a large field, I'm not just always going to fire away with my worst hands. I'd like to check some strong hands too. Meanwhile, we still have a very good hand. Ace king is yeah, I would say quite likely to be best. Not all the time, but quite likely. And if you check, especially in these 2-5 games, like where a lot of people aren't thinking about their whole ranges, like a lot of people are just going to say like jack 10, I have a draw, money in the pot. And I think you can get a lot of good check raising spots if you check. The problem with that is that you commit yourself and committing, you know, seven or eight times the pot with one pair in a five-handed flop, in a five-handed pot, is not a recipe for having a good time usually in poker. However, you block ace-queen, you know, you block some ace-nine, you got some outs against ace-nine, queen-nine isn't always going to be in there. And, you know, I do think that people will play back at you. Checking and calling is another option. So that's what I think. I'd probably start with a check, probably for balance. I mean, what do you think of that?
I think it's telling that, you know, and not that people listening would know this, but, you know, later in the hand, Justin talks a lot about his decisions, but he presents the, you know, betting. He says, I see bet 55 into a 105 pot. And he presents that very kind of like matter of factly with no like discussion of, you know, whether he should do that. And I think that's probably fairly common. A lot of people are just kind of like, well, I have ace king and I flop the ace and, you know, I'm going to continuation bet. But okay. I think you're right that at the very least, it's not an automatic continuation. That's just like the idea of, well, this is a good flop for me, therefore I bet. You know, that's a chain of logic or a flawed logic that I would love to break in the minds of the average Thinking Poker podcast listener. And I think a lot of people, like, I still see that a lot from people, just this idea of like, well, it's a good flop, so I bet. And I think you're right that, among other things, like, it's not, ace king is not really that close to the top of your range. And really, the thing that defines, you know, how thinly you can value bet, right? Because that's what we're doing here. We're not expecting anyone to fold a hand better than ace king. So if we're betting, we have to be expecting that, you know, we're going to get action from a number of hands that are worse than ace king. And the thing, like, at least in theory, that should define how thinly you can value bet is the frequency with which you're going to be bluffing. This is the incentive that opponents would have for giving you action with hands that you beat. And this is a pretty difficult spot to bluff. I mean, I could certainly see myself betting jack 10 here if I have an open-ended straight draw that I raised under the gun. But, you know, am I c-betting even a draw as good as like king jack or king 10 into four people on this board? Not necessarily. So I don't know that this is a spot where I'm going to be doing all that much bluffing. And as you said, like, we do have quite a few other value hands available to us. So I think just, you know, in a five-way pot, like, this is a very different situation from a heads-up pot. You know, you can't just say, well, ace queen nine is a flop that I bet with ace king and ignore the number of people who saw the flop. It is a quite different situation. We are not going to be able to value bet as thinly. We can't expect to get called as thinly. And we should expect that, you know, better hands will be out more often. The chances of one of four players having outflopped us are relatively high. I don't think we have to be terribly concerned about protection. A lot of the hands that are going to benefit from a free card are not going to fold the flop anyway. And, I mean, we have some interest in making a hand like 10-9 fold, but not that much. I mean, I think, like, a worst-case scenario where the flop checks around, it's much easier for us to get value confidently on a lot of future streets, and it's not that likely that that free card is going to, you know, suddenly end up costing us the pot. The other merit of checking in multi-way pots, especially when your relative position is so bad, is that you get a lot of information. So, I mean, you don't even necessarily need a plan when you check. I mean, you mentioned check raising, Nate. I feel like I'd probably be more inclined to check call, but part of the thing is that you get to see what everyone else does behind you. Yeah. I can certainly imagine scenarios where I check fold.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Check, somebody bet 75, two people call. Like, I'm folding.
Sure. I mean, I think... Yeah, so I didn't mention check calling. I think your view of this might be a little bit different if you played a little more 2-5 specifically. So the bet call, sometimes you can overcall there. I standardly fold, but more importantly, even in a five-handed pot, when calling ranges get really wide and when people tend to play a little bit scared in big pots, you said you're not going to be bluffing in this spot a lot, when in fact it can be a great spot to run a 2 or 3 barrel bluff, just because you look really strong and you have them so capped and they have so many hands that can call once. It's pretty nice. I think probably that changes as you move up in stakes, but two more notes there.
Yeah, I think all of that is fair. Anything you want to add, Carlos?
No, the main point I was going to make, you made, which was what I like about checking is right now we have the worst possible absolute position, but by checking, we can improve our relative position, given that we get to see how the other players react. And this is something that I used to do a lot when I was playing cash games more frequently, because, like Nate said, at these lower stakes, and I play even lower than 2-5, you get a lot of multi-way pots. And so when you're out of position, you have so many people behind you, I think checking is probably always going to be a reasonable option to consider, just because you can improve your position so often in situations like this where you kind of desperately need to.
Yeah, I like that.
Right, well, here's our flop action, as I mentioned.
I'd bet more if I were bluffing, and I'd bet more with a value hand. Like, you look strong enough. Like, even if people aren't sensitive to the number of to the handedness of the pot.
Yeah, just betting into this many people.
You're showing strength. And also, like, it makes their call, like, much, much worse if they call with a worse ace for 75 as opposed to 55. So I'd probably bet 75 or 80. But that's my last thing I'm going to say about the flop.
Well, we're looking at an ace-queen-nine rainbow flop. Our hero has raised under the gun, been called by four players holding ace-king. And Justin chooses to bet $55 into a pot of 105. The villain, I'm not sure if he actually gave us the villain's position. He just said four people called. But the villain has position on him anyway. Villain raises to 175 and everyone else folds. It does actually make a difference, you know, whether the villain raised with three players, you know, still stacked behind him, or whether, you know, multiple people had folded before the action was on the villain. Like, that makes some difference, but, We don't have that information, so, you know, certainly you can feel free to condition your responses if you feel like it would make an important strategic difference to you how many people behind had raised. But here's Justin's thoughts. It seems to me that this was the deciding point in the hand on whether to continue. Do I need to make a decision at this point whether I'm continuing with the hand and whether I'm willing to put my entire stack at risk? If I call the flop raise, I don't know what card I'm hoping for on the turn. I put the villain on ace-x, including ace-queen and ace-nine, queen-nine, nine-nine, and maybe jack-ten. I'm discounting queen-queen because I think he would 3-bet me pre-flop. If I re-raise him on the flop, then for sure stacks are going in at some point. If stacks get in, I don't see what hand I could be good against. His stacking off range crushes me. Again, I've never seen him raise on the flop. If I call, then I'm playing my hand face-up as basically one pair ace-x, and if I check call down, then I'm playing it as a bluff catcher when I don't know the villain to be capable of 3-barreling as a bluff. So I can certainly understand why he's kind of torn about what to do here. I think he, you know, lays out nicely some of the disadvantageous, you know, to some of the downsides of his options. What do you guys want to do?
I'm probably folding.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. I think probably a fold is good. We have so many better hands to call with, and... Yeah, I mean, he could easily be bluffing with Jack-10. I mean, not like easily, but I think a lot of people just see a draw and don't want to call in this spot, so they raise. But not that hard to have a set. And I wouldn't discount queen-queen all that much. So, yeah, I just don't see him raising ace-jack for value. So if he's under-bluffing, which he probably is, and if we can't beat any value hands, I think there's a hashtag for this, Andrew.
Right? Yeah, I was thinking the same. This feels like a they always have it situation.
Yeah, and again, they always have it does not mean they literally always have it. What it means is that if they're under-bluffing, you can just fold your bluff catchers.
And that's the really important thing is to recognize that this is a bluff catcher. Justin says, I put the villain on ace X, including ace queen and ace nine. And I guess the implication is that he's saying, you know, maybe the villain just has like ace 10 or something. That does not seem very likely to me at all. I don't think the player has a lot of incentive to raise a hand like ace 10. I think that the thing you tend to see least often from more passive players in general is kind of thin value stuff. So what you see most often is raising with strong hands. You'll sometimes see bluffing, especially as you mentioned, Nate, semi-bluffing. I think you're least likely to see people essentially raising here with ace-10. Like that feels to me like the least likely scenario. I think when calling feels like a perfectly viable option to people, especially more passive players, that's what they prefer to do. And I think, like in this case, I think calling with ace-10 would be the right play anyway, as opposed to raising. So it doesn't seem that likely to me that he's raising a worse ace for value, at which point it really is just a question of like, how often is he bluffing versus how often does he have ace-king beat, right? That you do kind of just have a pure bluff catcher. I mean, you have blockers to his value range, but like you also have the kind of hand he might be trying to bluff you off of. So, you know, that I don't know that that's that relevant. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fold. I think a lot of what Justin says is right. Like you certainly don't want to be just like three betting and getting it in. If you call, you're still going to be just kind of making a like, at best, neutral EV call down. There's very few ways for you to improve your hand significantly on the turn, which means that, you know, you're still just going to be kind of in the dark on future streets. You know, the one other thing you could think that you're sort of, in a sense, drawing to on the turn is a check, like that maybe you can call now and then the villain will check behind on the turn. You'll know you have the best hand. So it's not necessarily the case that like the only time you can call on the flop is when you're ready to call down to the river or when you have a chance of improving your hand. Like it is okay to call in situations where you think your opponent is not necessarily going to bet the next street, even though your hand is unlikely to improve and you're going to fold if he does bet the next street. You just have to think the next bet isn't that likely. But it seems pretty likely to me here, partly because I don't think the villain has a hand like ace 10 that it would be likely to check behind on the turn. I think that, you know, the villain is either bluffing, which he very well may follow through with, or has a better hand than ace king, which he'll probably follow through with. So I think that, you know, it's not like we're just going to get to call and then go to showdown against hands that we beat. That doesn't seem like a very likely scenario to me.
Yeah. Okay. And I know we've been hard on him so far, so unfortunately I'm going to not stop that. We really do need to know the position here for at least two reasons. One, well, maybe we don't. Maybe it's a fold anyway, but it matters here for at least two reasons. The first is Jack 10 offsuit. If he can have Jack 10 offsuit, that's 16 combinations of Jack 10 instead of 4 or somewhere between 4 and 16, and that makes a big, big difference. Like if you actually go through and do the math, you know, 3 combinations of each set, 6 combinations of ace 9, like whether it's 4 or 16 combinations of draws, it changes the math a lot. So that's one thing. The other thing is that if the first guy bets 55 and then it folds around to me, like 3 people fold and it's around to me, like if I've got 9-8 suited, I'll just fold without thinking about it if I'm first to act. But once in a while, you know, if it's down just to the better and me, it starts to look a lot better to, you know, maybe wonder if he's got a bet sizing thing, if he's sort of testing the waters with that bet, and the price I'm getting on a bluff, you know, all of a sudden putting in $150 on a bluff starts to look like a pretty nice price, at least sometimes. So I do think the position matters.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yep.
There's something else I was going to say while you were... couldn't have been that important. Oh yeah. So the other thing is, Justin gives a couple of reads here on the villain, which I kind of flagged when he first gave them, that I didn't think they were that reliable. But I think a lot of people, when they're in this kind of situation where it feels like a close decision, or maybe even a point where like this is the kind of hand we might be like indifferent with at equilibrium, and so I think sometimes people they want to look to reads to try to like break that tie, which is a reasonable thing to do. That's when reads tend to be most useful, is when your decision seems otherwise close. But I think in this case there's a tendency, and this is something I see a lot when I post hands on the blog, especially like a what's your play sort of format, is people tend to rely overly much on that and go to that first as a way of making a decision. And so I just want to underline again, I don't think it's very relevant at all, this thing of we've never seen this player re-raise, he only calls or folds when facing a bet post flop. If you've only been playing with him for 20 minutes, I just think that's not nearly enough of a sample size to determine much of anything. The slightly more meaningful thing is when Justin says that he, Justin, had raised four out of the previous five hands pre-flop, never went to showdown, bet folded once, and he says, villain might perceive me as having a wide range and being too aggressive. I mean, I think there's a little bit more to that. I think you can often kind of feel when people are doing that. So I can imagine if the villain was, did sort of like a directed bet where he's like staring hard at me and kind of like throws the chips towards me in a sort of angry way or something. Like I can imagine some physical behaviors on the part of the villain where I might convince myself that he's up to something. But I think a lot of people, even if they have that read on you, they're not going to do that much about it. I think like they might have in their head like, oh, this guy is too aggressive. But a lot of people's response to that is like, I can't wait to catch him when I have a set.
Yeah.
And like trap him. I don't know that their response to that is necessarily like, I'm going to raise him with bottom pair, I'm going to raise him with a gut shot. I mean, there certainly are people who will do that. But I think, again, like, I don't know that we have that strong of a reason to think that that's what's happening here.
And this is a 2-5 game, which is not entirely different average skill wise from the games I play. And in those games, these people, if they're going to play back with you in a bluff, they're not going to do it on the ace high board. And in fact, you have the exact hand that they always love to put you on. So I don't expect someone to put you on ace king and then make an attempt to try to bluff you off ace king on this board. So yeah, if the board was low cards and the guy decided to raise a C bet, then I think there's more validity to him just coming after you because of how aggressive you've been up to this point, but not on this board.
Yeah, I like that a lot. See, I always learn something.
are we ready for results here?
Yeah.
All right. Justin says, I tanked and folded. And
nice. Good choice. Sorry.
Yeah, I agree. Cool. And the villain flashed an ace, which I would say makes me feel a little less good about my fold, because it would make me wonder, like, maybe he did raise me with the ace 10. But like, I think, ace queen and ace 9 obviously are still very plausible despite him showing an ace.
Yeah, I think so. It almost makes me feel a little bit better. Like, I mean, maybe not. It depends how sophisticated this guy is. But like, a lot of people, when they show a card, really myself included, are almost always trying to be sneaky. And I think ace queen and ace 9 make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, if he shows a deuce, then we got something to talk about. But, when he shows the ace, in my mind, he literally just showed me that he had ace queen or ace 9. There's no way that's ace 10.
Yeah. It could. I mean,
maybe I'm just more paranoid than you guys.
If it was ace 10, he would have showed the 10.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think every now and then you get somebody who just thinks that ace 10 is the nuts. Like, maybe they're a limit hold'em player and they're not used to no limit yet or something. Or maybe they just don't understand relative value very well, but like, those players are by and large not playing 2-5 anymore, or when they do, they don't last all that long. I think it's a good fold. So very nice fold, and thank you for writing in, Justin.
You guys want to do a ethics / etiquette question?
Sure. Always.
All right, this one is coming to us from Robert. Robert writes, I'm a new convert to the Nickcast and absolutely love your podcast. I initially thought I would stick to the strategy segments, but your interviews cover so much ground about real life in general that I'm binging on every minute. I'm kicking myself that I didn't find your podcast until after I'd booked my WSOP trip. Otherwise, I would have been at the Nickcast meetup for sure. Thank you both for such quality content. I'm looking forward to a chance to meet you guys in real life and hopefully buy you a beer or three. I had an interesting experience while in Vegas and wonder if you have any thoughts. It's more of an ethical / etiquette question rather than strategy, but it touches on several issues. This is from a multi-day tournament at Planet Hollywood, part of their PH Famous series. Buy-ins in the neighborhood of $360, very late in day one, last level of the day or close to it. Robert says, I've been playing very sound poker all day and have a very strong table image, but I was stuck grinding a short stack. I was under the gun one and open shoved about seven big blinds with ace jack offsuit. It folded around to the big blind. The big blind was a younger, experienced tournament player who was drunk. He was a happy drunk, chatting up the table loudly, having fun, and was experienced enough to play some ABC poker without all of his faculties. When the action reached him, he looked at his hole cards, gave a little laugh, turned to face me. He was in the five seat, I was in the seven. Looked me in the eye and said, this is the exact quote, dude, you're so lucky, I will call you light. Then he mucked. The dealer, who was one of these inexperienced dealers brought in to deal the tourney, started to push the pot toward me. I was still trying to process what had happened because I thought Villain had called. For about a second or so, I thought about speaking up, but I thought better of it, decided not to tempt fate, and released my hand, still face down. There's more to this, but let me just pause there. What are your thoughts on a comment like that, Nate? Is that a call?
I don't think so. I think it varies a little bit place to place, but you know, call is not a magic word. I mean, you shouldn't say it just to, you know, to protect yourself. I wouldn't recommend saying it, you know, loosey-goosey when the action's on you. But if you say, do you want me to call? You have not called by virtue of using some magic word. Dude, you're so lucky. I'd call you light. I mean, maybe he said, I will call you light instead of I would call you light. I could imagine a floor ruling that a call. And if you do, you don't have a lot of recourse. But I don't think that's a call. I think you say, dude, you're so lucky. You know, I'm going to call you light. And then you fold. It's pretty clear that you're speaking counterfactually or in general terms, and that you have not in fact called. You know, if you're trying to angle somebody, you know, that's a different thing. You shouldn't be allowed to do that. But I think it's a clear fold. However, I got another thing to say. When do you release your hand, Andrew?
When the dealer gives you the pot.
Yes. When do you not release your hand?
Before. You don't have a pot.
Very good.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Especially if there's doubt about whether the other guy called.
Well, I think he did get the pot. He says the dealer started to push the pot towards me. For about a second, I thought about speaking up, but I thought better of it, decided to not tempt fate, and release my hand still face down. As I scooped the pot, the player in seat said, this is new stuff now. As I scooped the pot, the player in seat six spoke up. Seat six and I had played many hours together over the course of the day, and I had developed a healthy and mutual respect. He told seat five to be more careful with his word choice because his choice of words had sounded like a call. Another player at the other end of the table chimed in to agree. Seat five insisted that he had mucked, not called. Seat 10, who seemed to know seat 5, or at least have significant history with him, piped up in his defense, offering the theory that his choice of words meant, I was planning to call you light, but my hand is too weak even for a light call. Given the fact that Villain had indeed mucked, that was obviously a plausible explanation, even though it wasn't quite on point with his choice of words. Rather than let the issue go, though, seat 5 began to argue with seat 6. Given his inebriated state, his tone, volume, and attitude escalated more than necessary. At this point, the table's been debating the issue for 45 to 60 seconds. The inexperienced dealer has been following the debate, a bit confused herself, and is still not ready to deal the next hand. At this point, seat 5 opened his mouth one time too many, so I decided to call the floor for a ruling, partly because seat 5 won't let it go, and partly because the dealer is losing control of the table.
Wait, what ruling? Jeez, the hands are dead. I mean, you can get like a counterfactual ruling, like a could I have forced them to call, but the pot's been pushed, the hands are dead. You know, that's this ancient history. Ain't nothing to rule on.
Yeah, I think maybe just telling the dealer, like, okay, let's deal the next hand or something is maybe the better. I mean, I agree that, like, you want to do something if the game is sort of, like, stalled on this point. But I think just, like, encouraging the dealer to move on, especially since you're the player who stands to benefit from a change in the ruling, like, I think you're going to carry extra sway with the dealer, an inexperienced dealer, just sort of be like, okay, let's move this along. That's probably all we need to do here.
Yep.
The floor supervisor eventually ruled that the hand had been folded. The original rationale for the ruling was that verbal action isn't binding out of turn, which was a factual mistake on his part. The verbal action was in turn, not out of turn. Even after the table corrected the factual error, he stood on the original ruling. Frankly, I think in his mind, the verbal action constituted a call, but since both hands were now in the muck, he was simply unwilling to remove chips from suit 5 stack and award them to me. By now, I regretted the fact that I had released my hand. If I still had live cards in front of me, I might have argued the point more strongly, and if I had actually rolled my hand over in that split second in between seat 5's verbal action and seat 5's cards hitting the muck, I surely would have argued until I was blue in the face. But I made a conscious decision
to release Jesus my hand. Christ. Oh, Bob, duh. I need to go get myself a cup of tea before this
I made a conscious decision to release my hand, and I had made that decision before the scene really developed at the table, so I couldn't disagree with the outcome too strongly. So lots of issues here. Can't do much about bad dealers or drunk players, though obviously both factors contribute to this dynamic. Anything I should have done differently in hindsight? Should I have protected my hand and raised a stink from the get-go? Did the floor make the right ruling? How would you have reacted? Thrilled to hear your thoughts and to meet you guys someday over a beer. Oh, and this is Rob. I was saying Robert, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes I mix up Roberts and Richards.
I got some notes, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation here. So,
you're the expert on these things. you're well recognized as the resident thinking poker expert on floor rulings.
Yeah, that's fine. So I think it's absolutely great that Robert likes the show and that he wants to buy me a beer. Unfortunately, 3 beers is more than I'm going to drink this whole year, if not for the next decade. So yeah, I might prefer a nice tea, but. Yeah, I think. but I think there's a few things going on here that I'd like to correct. So one is that just because an action is a fold under one set of circumstances doesn't mean it's always a fold, and the floor person is allowed to rule in the best interests of the game, and if you sort of. It's up to you as the better. You have traditionally, at least in poker rules, it is up to you as the better to facilitate your being understood and to facilitate, you know, everybody being on the same page. So I know that times have changed, but for example, back in the day, if I bet $10,000, then you put out a $1,000 chip and said call, or a better example might be 10 $100 chips and said call. It would be on me to make sure you understood the size of the bet before I flip my hand over. Those days are probably gone, but you can see the spirit of the rule, which is that, like, you don't get to angle people just because they did something that could be construed as a fold, and you allowed them to be deceived and put their hand in the muck. You know, that doesn't give you the right to steal 6 big blinds from them or angle them out of 6 big blinds with no equity. So that's one thing. And there's also, like, just a mistake about how English works here. Like, the future tense just is used to express conditional or hypothetical behavior sometimes. So, you know, if Oreos are on sale, I'm going to buy them or something. You know, that's
you know, good example.
Yeah. Which is maybe not a true claim, but...
Yeah, it's true.
yeah, I mean, just because you don't use a tense that more explicitly or standardly conveys hypothetical or conditional behavior doesn't mean that what you're saying is not hypothetical or conditional. And as we know, in a poker room, you can generally, not always, but generally you can say, if I had a better hand, I would call you. You know, as such, you should be able to say, if I have a better hand, I will call you. And you can even sort of leave off the implied antecedent there and say, I will call you light and fold. Now, I wouldn't recommend doing that because you can be misunderstood. And in general, you know, why would you open yourself up to being misunderstood and where you could force yourself into calling? And maybe even if you have a floor person that doesn't like to protect you against angle shooters can let you call even though you don't have a live hand anymore. But yeah, just in general, I think that, you know, poker's not a video game. we talk about the magic muck sometimes. This isn't Mario 3, where if you touch the lava, then you're immediately dead. There's no sort of, it's just not video game logic that decides these things, where, you know, one person's hand touches the muck, so he doesn't have a live hand anymore, but then there's this other magic condition that takes place, so he has to call without a live hand. It can sometimes happen that somebody has to put money in the pot without a live hand, but it's pretty rare. And oftentimes there's something has gone wrong if that has to happen. So yeah, so I wouldn't worry too much about your having, you know, missed some chance to get free money. I would be happy that you took down the pot uncontested, and I would spend more time worrying about your shoving ranges. I mean, not that you're not like this, but I think the right thing to do is to worry about your shoving ranges or your calling ranges, and not worry about whether you could have forced somebody to call with a dead hand.
Yeah, and long term karma wise, you don't want to win that way.
Yeah,
it's not worth it. Like you said, not only is it not worth it in general, and this hand specifically is six big blinds.
Yeah,
you got a drunk guy at the table. You got position on him. Just move on.
Yep, I agree.
I don't know if I mentioned this on the air before, but I think that the favorite ruling I've ever heard someone ask for was a tournament at the Venetian. You know, both hands were tabled at the end, and the dealer accidentally started to push the pot towards the wrong player. Like, the chips aren't, like, commingled with the stack or anything. Like, it's still very clear what the pot is. And, like, of course, immediately the whole table is like, whoa, 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 what are you doing? You know, and then, like, the pot gets pushed to the other player. And the player who lost the hand, who initially had the pot pushed towards him, claims that simply the pot being pushed in his direction means that he's allowed to keep it. And he calls over the floor and, like, gets in a whole argument with him that, like, just because the dealer pushed the pot towards him, that, like, means that he wins the pot.
Man, I mean, people are creative in these situations. But yeah, some things are like, it's the type of thing where people who try to, like, take advantage of these mistakes when they're in the situation, they benefit from it. If you remove them from the situation and present the scenario to them and ask them what they think, they always know what's right. And so, yeah. If you're in a position to benefit from it, just respond the same way you would if somebody asked you about a situation that you were not involved in.
It's a good Rawlsian point there.
Let me throw one more thing out in defense of Rob now, because I don't mean to, you know, kind of put him in the same category with that situation that I just described. I mean, I kind of imagine what's happening with Rob here being, like, not a professional poker player, maybe someone who doesn't go to the WSOP that much and that kind of thing, is, like, there's a concern that your own inexperience with, like, tournament procedure or whatever, like, is kind of setting you up for a reverse free roll here, where, like, oh, other players would have taken advantage of me if I, like, did some thing, and, like, I kind of have to, like, protect myself. Like, I kind of imagine this is coming from a more defensive place than from a, like, angle shooting sort of place on Rob's part. I mean, maybe I'm just giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Because absolutely. You can tell that. I think that's very, very clear. And I don't mean to be too hard on him, but I do mean, like, really don't worry about it. This is not the sort of thing you need to be worried about, except to the extent that you need to protect your own hand. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the central lesson here is just, like, wait, if there's any ambiguity about who's going to get the pot, you know, or, I mean, just in general, wait until the chips are pushed to you before you, like, just trade cards for chips. When you believe that you won the pot. But certainly if there's any ambiguity, like, just hold on to your hand. That's really the only thing you can do differently here. It's not really an important part of WSOP or poker to, you know, be able to, like, argue hard for yourself in these kinds of situations, which here, you know, I don't think there really was a bad ruling, but I think just, like, being overly concerned about, like, making sure that you're getting the most out of floor rulings or something is not that's not, like, the part of poker strategy that you need to be overly concerned about. And I don't think you're gonna I think in general we see pretty good floor rulings in Vegas these days, and I don't think it's going to be, like, a big problem for you that you're not sometimes you're not entirely sure, like, what the right thing was, or that you need to be, like, arguing hard for yourself in a situation like this.
I agree with that. And a good Bayesian read here is angle shooters don't write into the Thinking Poker podcast to get permission to shoot angles.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So thanks for writing. I really like these sorts of questions. And the good news is that basically poker is still procedurally speaking, a cooperative game where people are expected to, and really by and large do, help each other understand what's going on and work together to keep the game operating smoothly.
Last thing, Nate, because Carlos just used the term Bayesian, and it occurs to me we've had at least one person on Twitter who feels strongly about this. Do you want to define Bayesian? I think of the three of us, you're the one who uses the term most often, and it seems like not everyone knows what you mean when you say it.
Yeah, so how about this? I will refer to you to Wikipedia for like a full formal definition, but...
I tried that. Our correspondent was not satisfied with Wikipedia.
Well... Okay. I think if you want a formal definition, then reading one instead of listening to one is probably the thing to do. But the idea is to account for the base rate of something when you're determining a posterior probability of something. So when you say here's an example, like with the ace king hand, where the best reason to call the raise is because the other guy might have jack 10. If you're trying to figure out the chances that somebody else has jack 10, you can just consider the question, would he make this play if he had jack 10 on the flop, and just try to answer the question that way. Or you can take into account also the prior probability that he has jack 10. And here, that's determined by whether he would have played it before the flop. And this turns out to be a key point in the hand. So when I say Bayesian reasoning, I say that I'm usually talking about Bayesian updating, where the posterior probability equals the prior probability times the odds ratio. It's one way to say it, if I'm getting those terms right, and I'm a little bit rusty on some of the formal language here. But Bayes' theorem, strictly speaking, is that the probability of A given B equals the probability of B given A times the probability of A divided by the probability of B. So,
can I put out a different non-poker related example that I often see used in this context?
Yes.
You know, a lot of times you'll see like a small child might be very interested in dinosaurs. You know, that's a common thing, like a four-year-old is very interested in dinosaurs. Is it more likely that this child, when he grows up, will be a paleontologist or a bank teller?
Yeah.
And you might be tempted to say, you know, to kind of seize on the fact that he's interested in dinosaurs and say, oh, okay, well, he's going to become a paleontologist. But in fact, like, far more people become bank tellers than become paleontologists. So the sort of like base rate that any given individual will become a bank teller or become a paleontologist, like, very heavily favors bank teller. And so this child might be more likely than the average child to become a paleontologist and yet still be far more likely to become a bank teller than to become a paleontologist.
Yeah. So in the example here, you know, the question is Robert, you know, a genuinely good guy or an angle shooting scumbag? And one might think that, you know, people who wonder if they could have gotten six big blinds for free tend to be angle shooting scumbags more than the average person. But here, A, you know, even putting aside the fact that Robert was just, you know, writing into a podcast asking for a clarification of some procedural things and just, you know, trying to protect himself and showing a lot of good cheer as he did it. The base rate of poker players who are angle shooting scumbags is pretty low. And the base rate of poker players who listen to the show and write in and would bother writing in, would have any reason to write in, is probably even lower. So that is why we conclude that Robert is almost certainly a total mensch and not an angle shooting scumbag.
agreed.
Thanks for writing, Robert. All right, well, good show. Thanks for listening, everybody. You remember anything, Carlos?
Forgot how.
Hello and welcome.
Hello and welcome. What comes out of that?
You can say whatever you want. You can say from Arizona, I'm Carlos Welch, but you know, feel free to, you know, follow your heart.
Hello, welcome to episode 203 of the Thing from the Podcast from Bullhead City.
Okay.
Arizona.
And Nate is in Melrose.
Yep.
Melrose,
Massachusetts.
Yeah. Okay.
But you know, own it, make it your own.
You won't science. I dropped it up.
Anything you want to talk about before we get started?
It's fucking cold up here.
Not a problem in Arizona.